I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. In the studio with us this week is politics writer and seasoned political convention goer, Chris Hooks. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Jonathan.
Also with us is Observer editor Dave Mann, who has a lot of very interesting things to say about the Democratic Party in Texas. We're very glad to have him. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you for being with us. Later in the show, we'll be joined by documentary photographer Joanne Santagello to discuss her latest photo essay, State of Denial, which looks at gay couples legally married in other states, but living in Texas where their unions are not recognized. But before we get to that, what do you say we discuss the Texas Democratic Convention? A lot to cover, of course, but I thought we might start with who wasn't there. Ted Cruz was the big draw of last month's GOP convention. It stands to reason that Hillary Clinton, for example, might have delivered a keynote last weekend. Chris Hooks, where was she?
Well, she was not there, and neither was Vice President Joe Biden or New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Mm-hmm. Democrats had their convention last weekend. At the Republican convention, there were a lot of national figures that came, and that's kind of standard at conventions like that. They draw people. They come here to build connections in the state, and they come to raise money. At the Democratic convention, at some point during the planning process, there had been talks about bringing down Hillary Clinton, Biden, Gillibrand, that proposal was quashed kind of early on by the Wendy Davis campaign, representatives from the campaign, who thought that the main focus of the convention should be Wendy Davis, that there shouldn't be national figures, and also that those kinds of people might be unpopular in the kinds of voters that the Wendy Davis campaign is trying to attract.
I mean, that seems a little complicated to me from the standpoint of a Democratic voter in Texas. I mean, like, the bigwigs aren't here. Like, how am I supposed to feel as a Democratic voter?
So there were some with the party that really would have liked to have seen these people here, I think. There are people that are really popular among the kinds of people that would attend a Democratic convention. Hillary Clinton, obviously, is probably going to be running for president in 2 years, and her attendance at the Texas convention would have made a lot of people think that she's coming here because she thinks the state is viable, which is something that the state party really would have liked to see people talk about. Gillibrand and Biden are obviously really popular among Democrats, and so if you're trying to stoke enthusiasm at the convention among these people, you would have liked to see them here. But kind of the subtext of this is that the Davis campaign is running a campaign that's really heavily focused on winning over kind of moderates and independent voters, which is how she won her Senate seat in Fort Worth 2 times in a row. Mm-hmm. So they're, in some ways they're maybe playing cautious with the base a little bit in a way that other people on the ticket are not. And that's kind of a subtext to the decisions Democrats have been making that we're going to see play out going forward.
Yeah, it's a bit of a double-edged sword because, yeah, clearly the Davis campaign doesn't want to be seen on the same stage with Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or any of these people, and they don't want to get tied to Obama or national Democrats. But at the same time, I mean, one of the major roles of a convention, particularly a state convention, is to fire people up, right? These are the diehards. Right. These are the true believers. These are the people who are going to be out walking blocks and knocking on doors and getting people out to vote for your candidate in the fall. And one of the whole points of the convention is to fire them up and get them motivated and excited to do all that kind of grunt work. So bringing in someone like Hillary Clinton especially would seem to serve that purpose, in addition to kind of maybe raising some money and drawing some media attention, which are always good things. The squashing that just plays into the Wendy Davis strategy completely. And the strategy we've seen from Democrats for years, right? This, like, chasing the white whale, you know, maybe this year, like, moderate Republicans and independents really will cross over and vote Democrat. I mean, I'll believe it when I see it at this point. And yet that's the strategy that they've kind of been playing over and over. That's what, Tony Sanchez tried to do back in 2002. And that's what Chris Bell did in 2006. And that's what Bill White tried to do in 2010. Bill White especially, because he had these great relationships with the Houston business community. And Wendy Davis had these great relationships with the Fort Worth business community and had won over moderates before. And Bill White had won over moderates before in Houston. And it never happens. And so, you know, they keep chasing this and chasing this. And the problem is that they don't get their base excited. You know, I don't know, Chris, if you felt like there was a lot of excitement for Wendy Davis at the convention. I'm sure there was, but maybe, you know, there could have been more if some of these kind of Democratic stars had shown up.
Yeah, it was really interesting at the convention. It seems like there's kind of a divide opening up between the two people at the top of the ticket, Wendy Davis and the nominee for Lieutenant Governor, Letitia Vandepute. Letitia Vandepute is someone who gave a really fiery speech, and is someone who seems like a great retail campaigner. And it seems like they've both gotten better at campaigning since they were at the start of the campaign, but in different ways. Letitia Vandepute seemed like she really connected with the crowd there, and is also running a campaign that has a lot less resources and is more dependent on that idea of kind of getting the base out, exciting people, and getting Democrats who traditionally don't vote to vote.
So this was a big event for her.
Yeah, I think, you know, I you could talk about how big of an event the Democratic Convention really is for anybody. But but yeah, I you know, and I think there's a lot of people in the party that are looking at Letitia Vandepute and saying, well, this is someone who's in a much better position than maybe Wendy Davis is, and also because Letitia Vandepute's opponent, Dan Patrick, is a much better, you would like to run against that guy instead of Greg Abbott.
And that's a key point, right? I mean, Greg Abbott has been a Republican office holder in Texas for years. I mean, Republicans have been voting for him time and time again, and they're used to it and they're comfortable with it. So it's a tough task to get moderate Republicans to defect from Greg Abbott, and that's what Wendy Davis is trying to do. But when you get down to the lieutenant governor's race and Dan Patrick, I mean, Dan Patrick legitimately scares the you-know-what out of a lot of moderate Republicans because he's pretty far out there in a lot of, you know, conservative social issues. So it's a much easier task, or it should be a much easier task for Vandepute to try to, you know, get some defections from Dan Patrick. And so that makes Wendy Davis's job harder. That makes her strategy seem like a tough one. And the other thing I would add is that it just seems like the Wendy Davis campaign could use some mojo, some excitement, you know, maybe a Democratic star could have provided that. I mean, it just seems like the campaign's been flat. I mean, it's just like not a lot of energy, not a lot of momentum. I think some of that has maybe been a consequence of Wendy Davis not being quite as charismatic.
You mind giving us some specific examples of that?
Well, I just feel like the energy, you know, that kind of came out of the filibuster last summer through the fall. People were really, really excited about Wendy Davis. I mean, I knew a lot of people who weren't historically involved in politics, who wanted to kind of volunteer for the Wendy Davis campaign and thought this time was really going to be different.
Right.
And now, as we've gone through the year anniversary of the filibuster, it is really striking now. You know, when you look back to what the energy was a year ago, and obviously some of that was going to dissipate naturally, but when you look at the campaign, it just feels like the same old Democratic campaign for governor that we've seen. I mean, it feels like the Bill White campaign. I mean, we've seen this playbook before. We've seen this kind of candidate before. And I don't know that Wendy Davis, I don't think Wendy Davis thus far has kind of shown the charisma and the energy in her speeches and her appearances that some people would have hoped or some people would have expected from this media star coming out of the filibuster. And maybe if Hillary Clinton had been at the convention, maybe some of that energy gets people excited again about all the campaigns, Wendy Davis is included.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the reasons it might look like Bill White's campaign is because it's being run by a lot of the same people who have run those campaigns kind of time and time again. But I think it's going to be interesting going forward. Look at, like, Wendy Davis's kind of top-down, really, like, resource-heavy campaign that involves a lot of ad spending and a lot of these kind of very resource-intensive efforts to go after these, like, suburban soccer moms, the kind of the people that the Democratic Party has been chasing for a long time. And
right.
Then the other thing that the Democratic Party has been chasing for a long time is to try to get these people who have traditionally don't vote in a lot of communities across the state to get out and register to vote and vote. And so the few people at the top of the ticket are going to be trying to do very different things going forward.
Now, that's kind of the wild card, right? The Battleground Texas model, right? Battleground Texas being all these Obama staffers who came down to try to turn Texas blue. And they're doing kind of the grassroots turnout part of the Wendy Davis campaign. And they're talking about expanding the electorate and bringing all these new people in and doing grassroots organizing. So, you know, if they're super successful and they bring out a lot of new voters, that's kind of a wild card. You know, that could change the formula. But that's just hard to read how successful they can be. They've only been in Texas for a year.
What kind of presence did they have at the convention?
Battleground, not... I won't say that there were too present. Wendy Davis's people were there, obviously. One thing is, if you talk to people in the party, there's some real kind of discord that has come up between a lot of people on the party's end and the Battleground Texas end, which is something that we've known about and have heard about for a long time. But it does seem like as we get closer to the general election that there's a really kind of a consequential competition for resources and fundraising and this kind of philosophical debate about what approach is right for the party. And so if you see come November that Wendy Davis does about as well as Bill White does, but Letitia Vandepute using these kind of different strategies, if she does better, then there's going to be a debate within the Democratic Party about how best to have this organizational structure and what's the most efficient way to direct resources and the kind of general debate about what the party should be doing in the next couple of years. It was going to be interesting to watch.
Any other lessons learned from the convention there?
Well, a lot of people, Democrats who have been to many of these things say that it was one of the better attended ones they've seen in a while. They point to attendance at the caucuses that they have to determine party leadership, and they talk about the number of people that are running for positions in the party leadership as an indicator that things are improving within the party. In the past, because the Democratic Party had so little power and so little chances, there were fewer people trying to get a part of the party and run the party. And so I think a lot of people are kind of looking at that as a positive indicator. But it's hard not to come away from it and contrast it to the Republican convention where, there was a lot of really kind of crazy stuff happening, but the attendance was massive. People came out, were really energized and focused, and that's something that the Democratic Party will aspire to.
Man, they put on a good show.
Yeah,
right. They, it's slick. It's well timed. The Democrats always have their keynote speech at like 10 o'clock on a Friday night, which is like the media dead zone. Right, no one ever hears about it, and that always has puzzled me. I don't understand it. I mean, Republicans have their like keynote on a Thursday at noon,
right?
And it always seems to be well covered. It also helps that they have the governor and all the top officials in Texas speaking, but still, it just, it's always a contrast of like media strategies and how you get attention, and the Republicans always seem to be better at it. So I don't know. I think right now we're in a spot where there's a lot of pessimism. At least that's kind of what I feel about the Democratic ticket, and that can change. Things can always change, but I think for people who've watched Democratic politics in Texas for a long time, this kind of feels familiar. Mm-hmm. And the whole premise of this election was that it was going to be different than what we've seen before. And right now, I'm not sure that that's happening.
You didn't see anything that felt to you a little bit different this time?
Well, I wasn't at the convention, but,
right.
But reading Chris's coverage and kind of seeing what had been done, it didn't seem like, drastically different. And again, the convention's not necessarily for people on the outside, it's for people on the inside. But I think if you look at the campaigns as a whole, Wendy Davis has a lot of money, so that's good. Bill White had some money too, so it's not like funding was an issue. I think it just kind of, again, it feels familiar. Again, the only wild card being Battleground Texas, and if they can turn people out, that can be a difference maker. But outside of that, it's like, Bill White part two right now is kind of how I'm seeing it, and I could be totally wrong about that, but it just feels like kind of deja vu all over again right now with Wendy Davis.
We've been speaking very pessimistically, and it's absolutely possible for the Davis campaign to turn around or for circumstances to change for them. But if you're a Democrat and you're looking for good news or optimism, then I really think you have to look at Letitia Vandepute going forward. I mean, the circumstances between her and Davis's position are just really different. She may not... You may not bet on her to win, but I think if you're looking for evidence of some kind of ground shifting in Texas, her campaign against Dan Patrick is going to be really interesting.
And she's taken stands that are more popular with the base, and I think that's important.
Yeah.
Wendy Davis, in her efforts to try to reach out to moderates, she's taken positions that are not popular with the Democratic base. I mean, she's kind of come out for open carry of guns. Her stance on immigration with the kind of influx across the border now of kids, calling for a special session of the Texas legislature. That was puzzling to a lot of people, given the bent of the legislature right now. She's had a number of positions, you know, kind of endorsing some restrictions on abortion that she seemed to have opposed before. So it there have been positions that I think have puzzled some people among the Democratic base, and that's not firing people up. One of the reasons people flocked to her, I think, during the filibuster, one of the reasons she became such a star is that she did stand up and fight. She stood up on a core Democratic issue, on a core liberal principle, and fought the good fight. And even though they lost, she kind of became a star because she seemed like she was fighting the good fight. And I think she's lost some of that mojo, some of that, you know, air to her campaign because she's kind of going after these moderate voters and taking these positions that aren't popular with the base.
Well, Chris and Dave, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Same-sex couples who make their homes in Texas but were married elsewhere are denied access to 1,138 federal rights, benefits, and privileges because the state does not recognize their unions. This is the focus of Austin-based photographer Joanne Santangelo's latest photo essay, State of Denial. For this piece, she visited with six couples in this precise situation to document how the barrier to these rights affects them and their families. Joining us to discuss this piece is the photographer herself, Joanne Santangelo. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
Also joining us to talk about this is one of the couples profiled in her piece. Cleopatra De Leon and Nicole Demetman are one of the two couples who filed a 2013 federal lawsuit challenging Texas's ban on same-sex marriage. Cleopatra and Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
So to get us started here, Joanne, can you tell me a little bit about what made you decide to do this piece?
I mean, it personally affected me, so that was one of the main drives. But actually, Jen Reel, the multimedia editor at The Observer, approached me and asked if I would be interested in working on this piece.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd always been interested in the subject. I've been documenting LGBT issues as the main focus of my work for years. So when she approached me, I, you know, jumped on it right away because this is an issue that affects me personally. And I know that there was a lot of people out there who had stories that needed to be told. Just to show that we are, you know, all the same. We're all just human beings who just are trying to live our lives, and it shouldn't matter about our sexuality.
Right. So how did you go about finding the six couples that you profiled?
It's always a search. You know, it starts off first with, you know, contacting people I know who might know other people. So I just start spreading the word out there. I started posting on various websites that might have people who would also see them that would be interested. And then I started contacting, that's how I found Reverend Margaret and Monica, was I started contacting the MCC churches around the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Because I figured that if couples, the one people that they talk to are their pastor, so maybe to try to reach to the smaller towns, because it was easy to find people in Austin, but I really wanted to spread it around the state and to get the voices of LGBT couples in smaller towns who normally don't have a chance to be heard. So the churches were a great asset, and I did find a few people via that.
We should mention that MCC churches allow members of the LGBT into their congregation. We've written about them before on The Observer, and I believe we've talked about them on Observer Radio as well. In either case, one of the things I found really interesting about this piece, and of course a bit disappointing as well, is that there are a lot of rights that the couples profiled in your piece don't have that are pretty regularly discussed in the media, like next of kin status, for example. But I got the sense from your piece that there are several aspects of this that were very surprising and maybe even difficult to anticipate. And I'm wondering if that's the case and if you can give us some examples.
It's just like the adoption issue, like the fact that, you know, in Texas you cannot have two same-sex partners, you know, name be on the birth certificate. It's that, even though I was somewhat aware of that, I wasn't aware that it was because of a law, you know, that was rewritten in, I believe, 2002, if I'm remembering, you know, that clearly states that only a man and a woman can be written on the birth certificate. And I wasn't really aware of that until I was out in Amarillo, you know, where I met Chrissy and Rissy, who are battling that with their birth certificate, and where their daughter right now does not have a birth certificate because of various issues in the state. And, you know, it's just certain things like that that you just don't think of in day-to-day life. You know, you think like, oh, yes, I might have issues at the hospital. I might have issues here. You know, I may get discriminated, you know, with health benefits. But it's just little things that you just never are aware of.
Well, Cleopatra and Nicole, I know that this is an issue that you deal with. In the piece, one of the quotes that you have that really stuck with me is that you wanted your child to know that you were as married as you could be. Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Sure. I mean, you know, we were pretty devastated when Texas passed the ban. That was really hard. You know, we knew it wasn't legal before then, but that, you know, the constitutional amendment was just pretty devastating. And, you know, around 2009, we had waited as long as we could wait. And, you know, we knew we were going to start trying to have kids. And in our minds, you know, it's funny because this issue is sort of seen as, you know, oh, you're so liberal, you know, you're for gay marriage. But really, it's a conservative value, right? I mean, we wanted to be married before we had kids.
Right.
I mean, that's it. That's all there was to it. I mean, that there's a name that you give kids that are born outside of a marriage. And, you know, we didn't want that for our kids.
And now that you guys are married and one of you has adopted your child. I'm sorry, what's his name?
We don't actually say his name.
Oh, my apologies.
Yeah, no worries.
But you guys are also dealing with this problem that that one of you presumably can't be on the birth certificate. Is that right?
That's right. I'm not on the birth certificate. That's Nicole. I'm not on the birth certificate.
Okay.
And so basically, I had to adopt our son, but I'm still not allowed to be on the birth certificate. So even though I am his legal parent and I have, thank God, all the obligations, that any other parent, has to a child, I can't be on the birth certificate. And the reason that stings is because, you know, I didn't come into his life after he was born.
Right.
You know, we conceived of him as an idea, you know, together.
Right.
Inside of our relationship. You know, just like any other child that's born inside of a marriage. You know, we conceived of him, you know, after we were married, and he was conceived when we were married. And so the fact that I'm not allowed to be on the birth certificate is a bit ridiculous.
What was it like when you guys decided to challenge the Texas ban?
I think there was a lot of anxiety around the decision. We knew that by challenging the ban, we would expose our personal life to a lot of scrutiny, as well as you know, just sort of getting pushed into the public eye. That wasn't something that we were looking forward to. It has been a sacrifice, but we believe that the cause is worthy. And so it's sort of one of those things that comes along with the job.
And we also feel that, you know, as we didn't know this at the time we were making the decision, but as we have sort of shared our story, we feel that just that aspect of it is making a difference, or at least we hope that aspect of it is making a difference.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so maybe there's still people out there who don't know gay families. You know, in Austin, that may be less and less the case. But, you know, in San Antonio, where I'm from and we both spent a significant amount of time,
I'm not so sure that that everybody in town knows of an open gay family. And so to see us and to get to know us, you know, we hope that, you know, people start to see that we really are. It's not just that we're demanding special rights. It's that we're demanding equal rights because we're really not different from anybody else.
Joanne, I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking about some of the other couples that are profiled in your piece and what you learned from them.
Sure. Let's see. I mean, the main one, like I talked about, Chrissy and Grady, Chrissy and Rissy up in Amarillo, you know, I learned that really brought to the forefront about the birth certificate issue. Even though I am in the process of having a child in the process of trying to have a child and going through everything with my wife, you know, I knew we had to adopt, but I really was not aware that there was a law that was changed, you know, to the Health and Human Services Code. So they taught me that and opened my eyes. And just listening to Reverend Margaret and Monica and their love, you know, they've been together, 20-some years. And what they hit in the quote, and I believe it's the quote that the Observer used, was that, you know, Margaret was like, if we both end up in a nursing home, the fact that they could separate us into two rooms really, like, hit home to me. Because I was like, I never thought of that, you know. It's just like you can go a place and be like, oh, I spent my life with you. We're going to, you know, want to die together, and we happen to end up in a home, and now they can separate us if they want to, you know. Like that really, it's just little things where even though you live these day-to-day lives, you know, when you hear people's personal stories, it really kind of hits home for me, and I think that's half the reason I do the work I do, is to just, you know, show people the human side of us, you know. In the end, it's just love, you know. Love is love, and they were great. Like Sadie and Michelle, you know, they spoke about how they don't really have much issue. They have a great support system of friends. They live in Austin. They have their son, but they fear when they travel. You know, it's just like you never know when something could come up. You know, you never know when, you know, you forgot a certain piece of paperwork. And the fact that we have to constantly live in fear of paperwork, and if you crossed a T or dotted an I, or if there's something else that you didn't know that you needed, or a new law comes in that you didn't know, because, you know, politicians sneak in different laws and bills that get hidden. And so it's just, those were a lot of the little things that I had learned, that you just never can feel 100% protected when you are, you know, considered unequal.
Right. Well, I want to thank all of you for being on the show today. Really shared a lot with us, and I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
The photo essay is called State of Denial. You can read it on texasobserver.org. We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Some special thanks go to Patrick Michaels and Jen Real for taking care of the show while I enjoyed some beach time last week. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.